Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Jim Johnson, and from his massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the Honorable Distinguished Dr. Henry Day. Do we have Dr. Day?
Yes, we do.
Well, good evening, Doctor.
Well, good evening. We had a little technical difficulties there.
Yes, we did. I don't know what happened, but hey, we're here.
I don't either. Guys, I called in as the host. I'm not sure what's going on. I'm kind of thinking that maybe since I was dialed in on the computer, that it almost seemed like I had to dial in as the host because it threw up a message on the screen. So maybe this is something that we did not foresee coming.
Yeah.
Let me get a hold of Billy, and I'll see if he can call in and conference in the guest that way, since he's already got him online. Okay.
All right.
Give me a few minutes here. Okay.
Okay. So, Henry, what's going on there in Indianapolis?
Well, we're just above freezing here in Naptown, and I don't like it.
I don't either, but we could be in the perils that northern Indiana had when they had 7, 8, 9, 10 inches of snow, so that's...
That's right, yeah. Yeah, we were good, actually.
That was very scary. That was very, very scary. I don't know if Wayne Larson can hear us or not, but the following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling is included. This is the Wild World News with the Honorable, Distinguished, and somewhat temperamental Dr. Henry Day.
Why,
go ahead,
you.
Doctor.
What a nice greeting. Good evening.
Yeah.
Well, would you like the Wild World News for December 1st?
Yes, we would.
Well, since we're so cold here, let's run off to another place that's kind of chilly this time of the year, Anchorage, Alaska.
Oh.
Now, we've got a few stories tonight for your retired animal educators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's one for your bears.
Yeah.
Anchorage, Alaska. Charles and Dolores Weiler, a couple in Anchorage Hillside area, woke Tuesday to the ruckus outside their house.
Yeah.
Now, it was a brown bear that had raided the bird feeders, knocked down part of a fence, and smashed up a dog pen. The bear then strolled out the driveway and headed towards a nearby state park, where he turned over a couple of outhouses and toilet paper. Okay, I made that last part up.
Yeah.
But that's pretty normal news for Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah, that's pretty much normal.
That's
a good bear story, though.
All right, well, let's warm it up a little bit. Let's head off to Cocoa Beach, Florida. Now, the increasing number of the endangered leatherback sea turtle nests this year increased to 600. Now, why is that? Well, it might be attributed to the massive blooms of jellyfish.
Oh!
As we've reported over the last several months, the jellyfish seem to be doing very well this year. Now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration researcher, Kelly Stewart, said the jellyfish are the preferred food for the turtles. And that can help the females reproduce more often, having the, you know,
well,
right food to eat.
That's right. Anything to help those females, that's We're all four.
Yep.
Don't go swimming there.
That's right, right. And as everybody knows, we love those baby turtles.
Yes, we do.
All right, well, call in your wolves. Here's a
okay.
story for them. Now, you have two of the biggest wolves I've ever met in person. And you kind of treat them like big doggies. And,
yeah.
But anyway, call them into the room because this story's for them.
Okay.
Pass, Oregon. A young wolf has become a media celebrity while looking for love. Now, the wolf known as OR/7 trekked hundreds of miles across the state, almost to California. Now, biologists know about his movements because they have fitted him with a tracking collar. Every time he crosses the county line, his track makes it into the newspapers and the local news. Now,
well.
The conservation group Oregon Wild began a contest to give OR-7 a different name.
So what's the different name? They haven't decided yet?
Oh, no, the name hasn't been decided yet, but anything would probably be better than OR-7.
How about Henry Mancini?
Oh, I love it.
Don't ask me why.
All right, if you're in Jackson, Wyoming, and you see some deer wearing some bling, here's why. More mule deer will be fitted with a global positioning system collars next month to study their migration. Just because there's been so many accidents there in Jackson's Hole with, you know, with the collisions with vehicles.
Oh, yeah.
Another 26 were equipped with the collars last year, and another additional 14 will have collars attached to help improve the city's sample size, you know, get an idea how they migrate, and so they can figure out how to not have any more of these accidents.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good idea.
It is. Yeah. All right, now I'm going to do a story for me since I'm a Kansas boy, and then I'm going to do one for you that's out in God's country.
Oh.
All right, Wichita, Kansas. Now, you you know about the nesting eagles. You have a couple that nest not far from you.
That's
well,
right.
A lot of people don't think about them starting to nest this time of the year. Well, two nesting bald eagles have taken up residence near a shopping center for the third year there in Wichita. Now, the male was spotted around November 11th on a little island there, one of the islands that gives the name to the Twin Lakes Shopping Center.
Mm.
And the female showed up a few days later, and the two have started building a nest.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yep, in December.
Yeah, that's great news.
And two eagles in a pear tree. All right, this one's for you, God's country. Now, 'tis the season, and it's not really an animal story, but I'm doing it anyway just to show people how wild it is. A family of four was rescued after they got lost searching for a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
Now, the sheriff spokeswoman, Jackie Kelly, said that the family in the Buffalo Creek area on Sunday went looking for a Christmas tree to cut down when they realized they were lost.
Oh.
Family vacation, huh?
Yeah.
The family called for help and was rescued finally by a search party.
Well.
And as we've talked about on the show before, you know what it's like to be trapped in a snowstorm.
I certainly do.
In Colorado.
In Colorado, I absolutely do. Without a doubt.
Gentlemen, can I interrupt real quick?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to interrupt on this. I didn't know. I just want to let you guys know that everybody is now here, okay?
Oh, I found that out, Wayne. Thank you
okay.
very much. Okay. Appreciate you. That's
sorry about that. Larkin. Sorry, Henry. I didn't want to interrupt Henry there, but I did want to give everybody the heads up that we are all here now. So.
Oh, wonderful news. The Taliban has been once again beaten again.
Yep, and sorry for the technical snafu there.
Okay.
Thanks, Wayne.
That's the voice of technical engineer Wayne Larson, who's always on top of the game, just like our honorable Dr. Henry Day. Dr. Day?
Yes, sir.
Okay, go ahead. I'm so sorry.
All right. Let's see. Well, where were we? Let's see. We're running a little long tonight, so I'll try to round this up.
Okay.
Your good friend, I don't know if you've heard or not, but your good friend Betty White, and a lifelong animal lover, has a new book out.
Come on.
Yeah.
It's called... What is it called?
We don't even know the name of it. Dr. Day.
I've lost it. Anyway, your good friend Betty White has a new book out.
Good for her.
Well,
put your track research down.
Hold on.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Day.
All right, now let's get on with this. Now, last night when I talked to you on the phone, you were feeding your six tigers.
Yeah.
And while I was talking to you, I could hear them enjoying their dinner.
Yeah.
And for people who have never fed large cats before, could you kind of explain what that sounds like?
The earth moves, that's all I'll say. A lot of roaring and the earth moves. That pretty much sums it all up.
All right, well, let's get on with this because we are running long.
All right, here's
the two fun facts of the day.
Despite
its hump, a camel has a straight spine.
Yes,
and here's
they do.
Something to think about right before you're falling asleep tonight. Penguins have an organ above their eyes that converts seawater to fresh water.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you very much. So that's
all
the
right,
wild
well,
world news?
Wild world news for December 1st.
Well, thank you to Dr. Henry Day on the night of technical difficulties. We really appreciate the effort that his staff puts on each week putting together our Wild World News. And too bad they didn't have the book title, but we'll have that for you next week. We want to tell everybody to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Also, RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And why not listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. We call that God's Country. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
The people came and listened. Some of them came and down in Monterey, down in Monterey, young God smiled upon the crowd, their music being born to blow, children dance night and day, religion was being born. Fly. Oh, Ravi Shankar's music made me cry. The hoop exploded into fire and light. You, Master Gayla's music was black as night. The grateful dead. Jimi Hendrix, baby, believe me, set the world on fire. Yeah. His Majesty, Prince Jones, smile as he moved him off the ground. 10,000 electric guitars were grooving real loud. Yeah.
All the way from Los Angeles, a brand new book out. It's called A Perfect Haze, The Illustrated History of the Monterey International Pop Festival. Folks, it's a great pleasure and so wonderful to have him on. Finally, Harvey Kubernick. Good evening, Harvey.
Good evening, Larry Batson.
Gosh, it's so great to hear your voice.
Thank you.
What a night. Wow.
I'm just happy to follow Eric Burdon anytime he sings Monterey.
Isn't that a wonderful song?
Yeah, I really like it.
It is so much picked up the mood of that festival, that 3 days in June in Monterey, California. And I have to tell you, you were so kind to send us a copy of the book, and I treasure that. What a wonderful, I'm telling everybody that's listening tonight and is going to listen to this in the future, what a great Christmas gift this would be for your friend, relative, whoever that loves classic rock.
It's, well, here's what's really one of the interesting things about this book, and I think you would agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the more you discover this book and check it out and surrender, it becomes less about the Monterey International Pop Festival. It becomes a book about your own record or CD collection.
Yes.
And
so well said.
For anybody out there who's listening to me in Indiana, and I know it's been a hard year with Peyton being injured and everything, I just have to say that if you really do like rock and roll and you like classic rock music, or you understand the secret tunnels and alleyways that connect rock and roll, and you happen to like the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan or even a lot of new music out there, when you go through this book, you kind of realize we're all in this kind of game together, and it becomes really not about Monterey Pop Festival, as I said. It becomes about the music we've grown up on, we still listen to on cable or the internet or on our own homes, and it becomes a almost multi- or cross-generational kind of journey. I mean, that's what I'm feeling. And also, I kind of feel that the Monterey event, a really landmark, you know, effort for rock and roll, has sort of been this hidden stepchild in the history of rock and roll. It's been trotted out occasionally, but it's been never been able to eat at the dinner table with all the other festivals. So my brother Kenneth and I, who did this together, have made sure that Monterey will now and forever be sitting right at the front of the table.
It should be. It absolutely should be. I had the opportunity today. I spent some time looking up the DVD series about the original movie that was filmed,
mm-hmm.
and also the outtakes from the event.
Right, the Lost Monterey episode, yes.
Yeah, which were quite spectacular. And what was so, I looked at the audience and thought to myself, what a fantastic audience, because they sat down the whole show. They sat down, they clapped politely. It was like when Simon and Garfunkel performed, you could hear a pin drop.
Well, the audience and the people on stage were in it together, kind of like a real team. And, you know, there's a lot of factors that play into why this festival, this event, the movie, this book are so durable. I mean, I think this is only finding an audience now for the first time. It hasn't really been hidden for 43 years. Let's just say it led the league in passing, but nobody wanted to give it the award. Just to go a little football with you, it's always, mm-hmm. the statistics have always shown what Monterey was. It was a nonprofit festival. It was
mm-hmm.
a three-day night and daytime event. There was probably 50,000 people there, half of them outside on the fairgrounds and half inside. But six bands or groups that played at Monterey 2 years later played at Woodstock. And, a lot of careers were made at Monterey. A lot of talent was discovered. And the book also shows the the ongoing, you know, what would be the word, remunerations maybe, of what has come out of Monterey, an ongoing Monterey International Pop Festival Fund. I mean, a charity organization for 43 years that has been active, that has just helped so many people, whether it be at the Free Los Angeles Free Clinic, the San Francisco Free Clinic. It goes on and on. And, you know, it became like the template or the blueprint for other, you know, unity, you know, music and human being partnerships, whether it be the George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh, and even out on the West Coast we have the yearly Coachella music event. And these things just don't happen overnight. And when you realize that the guy Chip Monk did the lights and helped do the sound for Monterey, well, 2 years later he did that for Woodstock. And
yeah,
he did the lights for George Harrison's Bangladesh concert. So if you took a look at what Lou Adler and John Phillips, the producers at Monterey, and took a look at the technical people led by Chip Monk and assistant stage manager Al Cooper, and then you take a look at the bands on stage, the logistics, and how it was put together, maybe if Clive Davis didn't go to Monterey, he wouldn't have signed Janis Joplin to Columbia Records while she was, you know, finishing up a stint with Mainstream Records, or those kind of factors. You know, they all bleed into each other. So it was one of the motivating forces why my brother Kenneth and I, you know, decided to ratchet it up and go deliver with this book. I mean, I'm really happy with this book because I'm a guy that, you know, passionately cares about rock and roll. I mean, it's something that that's taken me on a four-decade journey. But this book's a little different from all the things I've written about or done for 40 years because I think a lot of people truly were not aware of this festival. I mean, sure, you can go on Wikipedia or the Internet, and, of course, people like you know about the documentary Monterey Pop directed by D.A. Pennybaker. But
right. There's
been such a bunch of new people in rock and roll or people who've missed this event. I kind of feel it's like the Super Bowl that people have left out of the 40 or 45 years of the Super Bowl highlight movie. I found like the hidden footage. And all of a sudden, there's a great game that it was left out, either due to technical omission, politics, nepotism, East Coast media bias. I'm not really sure because I'm not investing the energies, but the game is different now because I've got the football, and the football's going into the end zone. And there's points on the scoreboard simply by looking at the book, and if it brings you into a world that makes you discover the soundtrack album on Razor and Tie Records, or like yourself, really looking at the DVD Monterey Pop or the outtakes of Monterey Pop that Criterion put out, I've done my job steering you to these auxiliary or these ancillary properties, and you just say to yourself, wow, this festival really was a landmark achievement for pop culture. And I love so much of this music, I might not have ever heard it if it wasn't for this festival.
Oh, and there's so many side stories with the festival that make it so intriguing. I mean, that was basically a community that was created for 3 days. And what's wild is the stars were in the audience. I mean, no security.
No, it was a world where Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones could sit at the venue and not be hassled. Janis could check stuff out. It's the last moments where Jimi Hendrix loses his anonymity, if that's the word. And you know, there was a time where people mingled together, where it wasn't about the red carpet. Segregation, you know, laminates, access, full access, division, shall we say. Honestly, you went to the concerts with the people in the band in the 60s and the 70s. I don't know if it's a socioeconomic thing or security issues, which I totally respect and understand, don't get me wrong. But
right.
This was a moment where everybody was in the game together, and as D.A. Pennybaker, the filmmaker, makes a point in the book, and if you truly love the music and you love the movie Monterey Pop, and I encourage anybody to own it or rent it, I devoted a whole chapter to D.A. Pennybaker and the Monterey Pop movie. But he points out that he knew even early on in the production office at Monterey, which took place in West Hollywood on Sunset Boulevard, Pennybaker says, and he before Monterey, he had done the Bob Dylan movie Don't Look Back. This was his first color documentary. He said, "I knew John Phillips and Lou Adler were hatching an interesting game plan when they took the money off the table."
Yes.
And I'm not encouraging people to do benefits and play for free. I'm a big believer in the lubrication of economics.
Yeah.
But when money wasn't involved as far as artist payment, where somebody makes $100,000, the next guy makes $40,000, the opening act makes $250, you know, when you don't have that mishigas going on and the money and fee is not taken care, is not involved in the equation, but all the other things are taken care of: transportation, lodging, as much food as you can eat, including transportation to and from your next concert. Not counting all the networking and hooking up that goes down there, either for record deals or boy-girl stuff or camaraderie, or in some case of Al Cooper, he meets somebody at Monterey around the production, and he ends up using the bass player to form Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Those are the things that pop out of here. And so when you don't have money as an incentive as far as payment, lots of magical things can happen. And in this case, I think the proof is in the pudding.
Well, one of the great stories when it became a nonprofit event is that John Phillips had called Chuck Berry.
Yes.
And Chuck Berry was invited, and he told him on the phone, he said, "Chuck, it's for charity." And he said to me, "Chuck Berry only has one charity, and that's Chuck Berry."
Yeah, I have the Chuck Berry charity. Some of the bands at the time didn't understand playing for free, and I understand that. I mean, they didn't really have the – somebody like Otis Redding's management did, who knew the exposure would bring him into a new world, and nobody was really planning on what the movie would catapult, you know, these people to as far as viewing and expanding a demographic. But and let's face it, if the phone rang in 1967, and I was around then and – was watching this festival kind of being put together a little bit as a teenager, because friends of mine were handing out, you know, flyers on the Sunset Strip or bumper stickers, really. And friends of mine, you know, were going up there and making suggestions for people that John or Lou Adler should call. I mean, that's the kind of open society we had in West Hollywood. And, you know, my friend Robert Marchese, who later would manage the famous Troubadour Music Club out here for 10 years and actually won a Grammy producing Richard Pryor's live comedy album from the Troubadour. He went in the production office and he said, "Well, what about, Howlin' Wolf or Captain Beefheart?" And they called both of them, and they were currently on tours at the time and, you know, couldn't get out of those secured contracts. So there were efforts to really try all kinds of stuff. And some bands didn't play for free, and some people went, you know, got themselves out of paid shows to make sure they could be aligned with this festival. Because, I mean, now that we've all grown up in rock and roll, and I said to you, Larry, you can play, you know, a $5,000 show somewhere in Indiana, but you can play a $1,000 show, but halftime entertainment at the Super Bowl. We have these choices now of taking no or less money, depending on what the upside is or the visibility or the exposure or what the event will yield. But I don't think people had agenda or motives like that at Monterey. It truly was a pretty pure festival, I mean, as far as agenda and motives. I mean, a lot of people went up there maybe the bands were booked, including people were looking for record deals, but the audience wasn't going, well, who's going to sign with Columbia or Capitol? You know, people weren't thinking of names like A&R people, talent scouts, what label has the inside track of signing Big Brother, they may be leaving mainstream. People weren't thinking that way. Now the whole plot is shown to you before the movie starts.
Yeah. We're talking
different world. Different world.
Oh, absolutely different world. We're going to take a short break. As I said, we're talking to Harvey Kubernick. Folks, this is Larry Batson, and we're talking to Monterey Pop Festival. And you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio. And we invite everyone to check out our old shows from the past. Go to blogtalkradio.com/Larry-Batson, and you can check out all of our old shows, free downloads. We've got some fantastic shows, as well as the one we're having tonight with Harvey Kubernick and his brand-new book, and his brother Kenneth, I should say, as well, A Perfect Haze, The Illustrated History of the Monterey International Pop Festival. We also want to thank many of our underwriters, such as Cobalt Blue Press Bookstore in historic Knightstown, Indiana. The shelves are stocked with new and rare, gently used books. Great time of the year to find that special Christmas gift. Hard to find children's titles, and all you have to do is contact owner Shannon Dawson through Facebook or Twitter, or visit the store 7 days a week, free coffee, Wi-Fi, and they do have a cozy reading area, Cobalt Blue Press, corner of Main and Jefferson in Knightstown, Indiana. Also, the icebox. Why not, if you live in the cold country, build your own igloo? Igloo Ed makes that possible. Go to his website. It's a fantastic way to go camping. They build these igloos up in the mountains of Colorado. They stay there all winter, and anytime they want to journey up into those igloos, they can stay the night. Don't have to haul a tent. Here's their website, www.grandshelters.com. Fantastic idea. Also, the iKidsFishing.com is the first kids fishing show in the USA, starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake in Western New York. That website is www.wewantyou.com. It's one of America's finest fishing resorts. Also, Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, they keep our animal truck on the road, serving America's auto maintenance needs. Their phone number is 317-243-0700. Those are some of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
All the leaves are brown. If I
Mamas and the Papas recorded at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967 in the month of June. They were the final performer for the festival, and that's pretty exciting to hear, Harvey, I'll tell you.
Well, it's just, you know, it brings back memories, but like any really strong or potent music, it's still viable now. You know, time sort of vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like, you know, I have a poet friend, Harry E. Northup, who dates his poems going back, you know, 40 years. It says California Dreamin', but, you know, and maybe, you know, it came out in 1966. But if you hear it now, do you say to yourself, oh, well, that's 40 years ago? I mean, do we have to be reminded of it? I mean, maybe it still is relative now. All the Leaves Are Brown. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me now.
It does. Well, I had heard, not only heard this, but I read in your book that they sort of just got back together specifically for the Monterey Pop Festival. They had not played or performed together.
The Mamas and Papas performance at the Monterey Pop Festival doesn't deserve an asterisk, but let's just say one of the members, Denny Doherty, showed up at the Monterey Pop Festival 45 minutes or so before the actual booking time. They really didn't have a proper sound check. John Phillips and Michelle of the group, and this goes a little bit obviously to Mama Cass, they were serving as, you know, organizers or kind of producers of the event as well. It was a new form of, shall we say, multitasking. And
mm-hmm.
So it's, again, to use a football analogy, I know in the 50s and early 60s, football players used to play offense and defense sometimes. They were playing offense and defense, so it is kind of hard to make your show the priority when you are running around the festival goes smoothly and
mm-hmm.
doing all that stuff. It can hamper the performance, and I think
absolutely.
I think it probably shows up in there. The closing, by rights, they should have closed the festival. They had kind of put it together. It was not the strongest Mamas and Papas live show owing to the factors that I've outlined, but people were glad to see them, and it was kind of in a weird way, or not a weird way, they were waving goodbye as well as an active group too.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
it also kind of signaled on some levels the AM music that we knew, the AM radio music that these bands had come to into our lives from the AM radio dial. In that late 66, and obviously in 1967, the new FM radio band had showed up, and the new groups being nurtured or developed from the FM world were now going to be a lot more, you know, staples in the FM radio rotation.
Well, and there was such a plethora of artists. I mean, Otis Redding said that it basically added 5 years to his career, he thought. Lou Rawls is pretty much given a hard time for playing in what they call the White Festival.
Yes.
And it turned out that the people there absolutely adored him. In fact, I remember Janis Joplin making a special effort of seeing the Otis Redding performance. I mean, that's one of the reasons she was there besides performing.
Andrew Lou Goldham, who at the time was managing and producing the Rolling Stones and was on the board of directors for Monterey, Andrew said, because he was in the production office literally when Otis's manager confirmed the booking for the show, and as Andrew watched Otis's set, he says it in the book, and he said it to me. Phil Walden, Otis's manager, knew at that very moment Otis was going to be on airplanes instead of trains from now on.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, they were just...
I'm sorry.
You know, what can
Billy,
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Billy, I'm coming in on another line. I think my cell phone's going to die here, so you'll be seeing my line come in. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I can still hear you. We're all cool.
Okay.
So anyways, yeah, this is cool talking about this. I encourage people to go, you know, either to Amazon or if they have a Barnes & Noble across the United States. It's really a nice coffee table book, and it's really a nice holiday gift, but it also kind of is a compass, will steer you to some bands and people you've never heard of, which is the principal goal here that of the journey. And
yeah.
I really think that, you know, sure, we love Janis and Jimmy and Otis and Simon and Garfunkel, but you just might get your first Moby Grape album, or you might really go into a different part of the record store and get a Ravi Shankar album, or you might really realize how good the Byrds were. So this book is kind of the Geiger counter in some ways, as in the fact-finding mission to, you know, check out a lot of other music too, that has still, we're still hearing on reissue, whether it be on CD or MP3 or in soundtracks of TV and movie, but a lot of it started at Monterey.
Well, and the artists that were basically discovered, Jimi Hendrix, The Who, and as you mentioned, Janis Joplin. Are we coming through okay?
Yeah, yeah. What I find, it also, the book might bring you to the world of Laura Nyro as well. So there are some real gems of discovery that I encourage people, you know, to seek out.
I think when they started the festival with the association, they were kind of already almost like a Holiday Inn has been group.
Yes, but remember, they arrived at Monterey right on the heels of a number one record, Windy, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions I'm asked about the association, one of my favorite groups, by the way, is that Steve Cropper of Booker T and the MGs was arriving to Monterey when he was hearing the association do a sound check. Because they opened the festival, and he was very impressed by their harmonies and their chords and their song structure, that it influenced his co-writing of the Otis Redding song "Dock of the Bay."
Really?
So that's about if that is considered kind of has been or vanilla music.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Cropper dug it so much to understand the meter and the tempo. To tell me in the book that he brought some stuff of the association into Otis's Dock of the Bay that he produced and I believe co-wrote. That's some of the ephemera that Monterey sprinkles on anybody who surrenders to it.
Well, by the way, I love the association as well. I mean, I'm the first one to admit it, But
they were also plagued by what's interesting about the association. They were still wearing suits at the time, the way the Beatles came over in 1964 to America, all wearing the same clothing. And at Monterey, you noticed that the audience and everybody on stage were wearing different clothing. But the association, who had come out of the folk music world, arrived there with hit records and band uniform, shall we say. But rest assured, and Jim Yester tells me this in the book, and I've known some of the members in the band, they party just as hard as everybody, and subsequently after Monterey, they went and did a bunch of concert tours or concert shows with Jimi Hendrix, because they were, you know, on the same Warner Brothers or Reprise label together. So even after Monterey, they shared the stage with The Who or Hendrix, and they knew Janis and stuff like that. And, you know, the bands had a lot of communication. They were closer to each other as the audience was going through a sense of discovery, I think. But there are people who knew this music as well, that wanted to see if these people could play on stage. And so, you know, the book kind of shows the backstory, the setup, the big influence of West Hollywood. I mean, putting the It was produced in 6 weeks on Sunset Strip in West Hollywood. Yes, it was executed in Northern California on the stage at Monterey. But the older we get, we realize, just like your radio show, pre-production and teamwork is almost 80% of the ordeal.
Yeah.
Showing up and deliver is 20% of it. It's something Paul McCartney told me many years ago. I was at a sound check or something at a Wing show or something, and I was kind of grooving on it, and he said, hey, fella, there's 6 people on stage and 139 setting it up. And I didn't quite get what he was saying at the time, and he's, not that he was giving me a fact of life gesture, but
yeah,
he was just pointing out, because I stopped for a minute and I realized, well, gee, I kind of thought there was one or two road equipment people and somebody doing the lights, and I really realized there were like 3 trucks of helpers and support staff for the 6 people on stage. So,
yes,
you know, there's so much backstory and so much work done. So by the time you make it happen, there's a lot of stuff that goes on before. And as the UCLA basketball coach, John Wooden, by the way, a former Purdue All-American from Indiana, used to say in his conversations with us, and I know how popular the sport of basketball is in Indiana, he would say failing to prepare is preparing to fail. And the preparation of Monterey was so acute and so strong. And they were going on a Wing and a Prayer. Who would even know this could have been pulled off? But it did get pulled off, and it did get documented, and we benefit from it.
Yes, it was an absolute miracle. I mean, even they said that the setups from different bands did not hardly take any time whatsoever. They had an unbelievable sound system for that time. I mean, that's one of the comments that David Crosby makes in the film. He says, oh, finally, a good sound system.
And again, this is something Lou Adler pointed out to me in the book, but up until Monterey, really, and this goes back to rock and roll groups and doo-wop groups and duo bands, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s on tour, you were often at the mercy of the promoter or a house PA system. You know,
mm-hmm.
the logistics had not been developed for sound being carried or the big speaker system or multiple microphones. You could, and people were screaming at concerts, by the way. So,
yes.
You know, or you didn't have the great sound mix you would have later on post Monterey. So Monterey gave the artists some power as far as, I want this photo on my album. I want to make this song longer than 3 minutes. I mean, these things were going on before Monterey, but for a while the artists were given a lot more power to deal with record labels, you know, to say, I want to do this, and I want this person to be my producer. And artists got a little bit more control after Monterey and certainly understood the business of music. It's something the composer Carmen Dragon used to say, who did the soundtrack to the movie The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but he was the head of the Glendale and the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra for many years out in Hollywood, and his sons, one of them, Daryl Dragon, became the captain of Captain and Tennille, and another son ended up in a group called the Surf Pucks. And Carmen Dragon would say, the music business, small M, big B. And so you realize that the business of music sprung from Monterey. Concerts weren't going to be 450, 550, and 650 anymore once the 70s or 80s started. You weren't going to have 8 different groups on stage anymore, except for some holiday event, you know, outdoor radio station. That's the other thing about Monterey. The secret I found out about Monterey that was revealed to me, and my brother agrees with me on this, and listen, I'm not anti-music industry or music business. I mean, I was West Coast director of A&R at MCA Records at one time. I've been on both sides of the aisle. but it was a festival that did not have a strategic media partner. There was not a radio station involved presenting or being logoed out, if you know what I'm talking about. There was no disc jockey on stage introducing a band so you could get airplay the next morning in rotation. You know what I'm talking about. And I'm not saying any of that stuff is bad. But what we have here is a situation where other artists were introducing people on stage, like, somebody introducing The Who or somebody introducing Jimi Hendrix or Tommy Smothers. And so you have that kind of stuff that even the people introducing, you know, weren't in the media or weren't a television personality or weren't on a radio station. So you had all kinds of radio stations, KHJ, KRLA, KFWB in L.A., KFRC in San Francisco, KYA in San Francisco, AM radio outlets coupled with KSAN, an FM radio station, or even KMN in Salinas. So you had all kinds of radio people going to the festival, getting media credentials from Derek Taylor, watching the music, and then subsequently playing the music that they saw over the next weeks and months and years. So you didn't have any of the usual politics of concert promoters or a radio station, you know, with contest winners or their staff having the first 18 rows of all the good seats, you know, the kind of riff I'm trying to run down. None of that stuff exists then. Sure, there was priority seating, and a lot of the artists got the seats up front because they saw a show and they had to get backstage to get ready to do their own show.
Mm-hmm.
But it just didn't have the machinations of what rock and roll has become today.
Yeah.
And I think that really, you feel that once you travel through the book.
Well, it's a fantastic book. And I'll tell you, I hate to impose, but Harvey, can you join us again next week? We do a part two.
Yeah,
a week from tonight, same time, same place.
I'm going to a concert that night, and it's Jim Morrison's birthday, and it's the day John Lennon died. But I will come back in December. I mean, are we talking December 8th?
Yeah.
I'm going, but let me ask you something. Your thing is 7 to 8. I think there's that's a possibility.
Well, we'd love to. Let
me tell you something. Concerts don't. Interesting. I think I have a show at the Roxy Theater that night that I think I have tickets for already. But I will come back and I do want to talk to you again.
Yeah, because we have a gazillion questions we want to. Folks, it's a fantastic book. It's called A Perfect Haze, The Illustrated History of the Monterey International Pop Festival, Harvey and Kenneth Kubernick. And we're going to close out tonight's show with probably one of the most memorable performances of the festival from a gentleman that was from the United States but came back from England and basically blew the roof off the place, Jimi Hendrix and the Experience.
Thank you for your time, Larry, tonight.
Oh, well, have a great week, and we'll have Harvey back for sure because we've got lots more to cover. This
Thank
is Larry
you.
Batson.
I'll be back later on this year or something.
Fantastic. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Wow. Hello.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.